It's good to hear your voice. It's been up in the north as long as I have, and developing kind of a Midwestern flat accent. Anyway, it's refreshing to hear the sweet sound of a southern accent. The voices up here are so harsh.
Where are you from?
Well, originally I was born in Kansas, but I spent a lot of my formative days in Texas.
Oh, okay.
In Houston. So I kind of have one foot in the South,
right.
One foot in the Midwest and one in the South. My family still lives in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
But you've heard, remember Thelma Diamond? Remember her, the actress? She always talked like this, you know, and these real harsh, they call them Brooklyn accents, but they're not really Brooklyn accents anymore. It permeates New York and New Jersey and Long Island. And it's very, very harsh. It's almost grating. Have you noticed that?
Well, I can't say that my husband and his family.
Well, I mean, it's true, though.
Long Island.
I mean, there is a harshness to the New York accent that I think is unique in the United States.
Boston's pretty harsh as well.
Boston?
I think so.
Boston, yes, but it's kind of fun to hear a Boston accent. The way they pronounce the R's and so forth, you can almost always spot the Bostonian. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about you. I read Ferris Beach. I finished it yesterday, and it's certainly a beautiful book. I admired it very much.
Thank you.
I would like to ask you a couple questions about yourself and how this book came about. Well, let's talk about the book first, and then
okay.
We'll kind of work backward. Tell me how Ferris Beach came about.
I started writing it about 3 years ago. The original idea was just that I was going to have a young girl more or less spend a summer away from home, at which point she would learn the differences in her own life and what she had thought would be this glamorous world taking place at Ferris Beach. And then when I started writing, her best friend Misty moved in across the street, and that whole family was introduced, and the novel took an entirely different route and became much more than the simple coming-of-age story I had had in mind. It took on the whole community during a time of great transition in a small southern town, which is the time of integration and the end of the 60s.
So the novel takes place essentially over, I think about a five-year span, doesn't it?
Right.
Something like that in the...
There are flashbacks when she's 9, but for the most part, it's from, say, 12 to 17.
And wraps up about 1975.
Right.
Approximately. Where is the novel set?
It's a fictional town, but it's southeastern North Carolina and... upper portion of South Carolina, very much my own turf in terms of my upbringing.
Now, you were brought up in Lumberton?
Lumberton.
That sounds like a place that should be in Minnesota or Wisconsin.
It's only 20 miles north of the South Carolina line.
Mm-hmm. The town and the characters are very much like those that you encountered as a young girl.
The town, geographically, it said the characters are fictional. I think that once I have the setting established, it's very easy to create new people.
And yet they must spring from real life. Probably they are composites of almost everybody you knew.
Composites, and also, yeah, I think our experience incorporates much more than what's actually happened or what we have observed happening. It also takes on our imagination and situations we imagine and people we imagine looking at someone growing up in an entirely different way and saying, what if I had grown up in this house instead of my house? In this novel, I think I did a bit of that, and the narrator as well is doing that.
And the narrator, I have terrible time with the names.
Katie.
Is Katie, yes. Mm. Or Kitty.
Right.
Sometimes known as Kitty. But it seems like an idyllic time, but actually there's a great deal of violence in your book. I mean, there's a gang rape in the cemetery. There is an accident that claims the life of Katie's best friend's mother and the mother's young son. Let's see what else happens. There is a murder and a fire that destroys a neighbor's house. The murder is never solved, is it?
No, I think you have suspicions. I don't want to say too much, but I think that the reader should suspect a certain route. That
you mean R.W.?
Well, the whole R.W. The whole group, these gangs, mm-hmm. rival gangs.
And yeah, Katie was protected. Oh, and her father dies.
Yeah.
So there's
this is my gothic novel.
Yeah.
I have always wanted to write a gothic novel.
But the fact of the matter is, these things happen in all of our lives.
They do. And again, when I was first starting the novel and thinking of it in the broadest terms, what I kept thinking about is how often you look at one person or a family or a collected group of people, and there's the question, why do so many things seem to happen in this one place? It's like lightning striking again and again. And the whole notion that when such a situation occurs, you find that people either lose faith altogether and turn away, or either they are made stronger and they just turn face in. And I see Katie's friend Misty as being someone who just cannot be beaten down. She keeps bouncing back. And for me, it was in many ways a character study on how people cope with tragedy.
Well, one of the more interesting characters in the book is Angela.
Mm-hmm.
Have the name right? Angela?
Yeah.
And I had some suspicions about Angela, and none of them were borne out. But I had thought that maybe Katie might have been Angela's daughter. I mean, there seemed to be some implication there because of the closeness between Katie's father and Angela, but apparently that was not the case.
Right. That's Katie's dream, sort of that childhood dream that suddenly these rich relatives are going to appear and show you the lost treasure that is yours. Angela very much becomes Katie's fantasy. And over the years, when Angela is not physically a part of her life, the myth takes on greater proportions.
Angela is indeed a romantic figure, at least to Katie.
Yeah.
Although a somewhat irresponsible young woman who is the bane of Katie's mother. Another appealing character is the young man whose name escapes me, who becomes...
Merle,
that's right. He started off very badly, but at the end he turns out to be a hero.
Yeah.
So you have a very nice assortment of characters, all with very distinct personalities, all intertwining. Tell me a little bit about the writing effort and how you approach the actual task of putting these words on paper.
The idea certainly was brewing before I actually started writing the novel. I found that this novel was already coming into being as I was finishing the novel prior to it. And so I spent a long time just taking notes. And as I say, I had a lot of ideas about what Ferris Beach would be about, and these ideas never came to pass, because as soon as new characters stepped in, Mo Rhodes, who is the mother of the best friend across the street, in particular, once the roads moved in, everything took another route. And so I worked through the rough draft, as I usually do. I usually start writing and don't stop until I get to the end, because I want to make sure that I get my own ideas flushed out before I show it to anyone else. And what happened in writing Ferris Beach is that when I wrote the rough draft, I was very much in the character of Kitty and feeling very much like the daughter. And then between the rough draft and revising the novel, I had a daughter who is now 2. And when I approached the novel to revise it, I realized that there was a lot of me in the mother. And she started out as a very flat figure in the rough draft because I wasn't sure what to do with her. And as I was revising, I saw the mother growing and changing and becoming a real person, because suddenly I was looking at the conflict as a mother as well as a daughter. And so it was an interesting experience for me, because I saw that the conflict was within me, that I was both mother and daughter rather than anything external. And
well, it's interesting that the novel kind of, as you've implied, kind of shaped itself as you went along and as you yourself developed, as opposed to, say, a mystery novelist who probably has things pretty well blocked out, because it's usually a whodunit.
Right.
Most of them are whodunit, so you have to have a very specific ending. And I kind of wonder about literary novels where you... Bobby Ann Meason was telling me that often when she starts a story, it'll be a theme, like bumblebees flying into an attic, and she has no idea about the characters or anything, that it just kind of takes shape as she writes. Seems to me, in a way, kind of an awkward way of going to the typewriter, word processor, nothing there, and you have a theme, and then you try to force it out.
Yeah.
But, of course, you had said also you had been thinking about this for a long time.
But that, to me, is the whole challenge of writing, and what is exciting. So much of it does take place as you are writing, and so often the original idea disappears or ends up getting cut entirely out of the piece when you have completed it. Some of my best characters and favorite scenes just seem to fall from the sky. And that for me is what's so exciting about writing, is that I am surprised by what appears.
It's like opening up a succession of doors, isn't it? And each door opens up, you see something new that you can develop.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know if it can even stop. At a point, you have to stop, and you have to go on to other things, other books. Or some people don't stop. I mean, who was it? Harold Brodkey, who has been writing this novel since he was in his 20s and has yet to have it published, and he works, still working on it. Are you familiar with that?
I've heard. Yeah.
And it's incredible. And he is staking his entire literary career on this one book.
Well, Catherine Ann Porter traveled around with Ship of Fools, apparently, in a basket for many, many years.
But she turned out a lot of other things, too.
Yeah.
Brodkey has turned out some short stories and a little else. Now, everything is pinned. He was telling me that, to this one novel, he was telling me that he has taken some excerpts from this novel, which he has published in the New Yorker. But generally, if he finds something that seems to be publishable out of this novel, he won't send it off. He will work on it some more so that it becomes difficult. I was reading some of his stuff out of this novel in the New Yorker. It's tough, really tough. And I would say that's really a gamble on his part. Indeed, his entire literary reputation is going to be staked on one book. He's only had two other books published, and they were little books of short stories. Well, the last book was a large book of short stories. But there's only two books of short stories. So, I don't know. I don't know if that's... What if it bombs? I mean, the critics are waiting to pounce on him because he's ruffled a lot of feathers. He's a genius. I mean, he's got a genius IQ, and he talks about it. You know, so there are people who have jumped on him.
I would be terrified.
Yeah.
I like to, before I let go of a novel, I always make sure I've got another one started. And it's swapping, and as soon as it's out of my hands, I just try to just sever myself from it and focus on the new one and sort of pin all the hopes on the new project. Because otherwise, this would be a horrible time, because a book comes out and, you're nervous about it. But I just have to know that I have another project.
I think it's important. You're a young woman. It's important to go on to other projects because it's a part of maturation as a writer. I mean, if you live with one book all your life, I guess you can mature and do it one book. I'm sure Brodkey has, but I don't know. I'm anxious to read it. Tell me about your earlier books. You have two other novels, right? The Cheerleader and Tending to Virginia.
Yes.
Tell me about
actually, that. Three other. July 7th also, which was published simultaneously with The Cheerleader.
Those were your first books.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about those.
The Cheerleader is a coming-of-age story, first-person narrative, a very different voice. I, in many ways, felt I was making a circle when I came back around and approached Ferris Beach in a first-person and a coming-of-age, because The Cheerleader was in that vein, and then July 7th, is about a small town and the people, and it takes on all the points of view of a wide range of characters, male, female, old, young, and all of the situations within the town that connect them. And then Tending to Virginia deals with three generations of women within one family and all of the stories that have been handed down, and so there's a constant shift between past and present, as well as the different characters. And so after having taken on and juggled all of these different people in their lives, I was very relieved to get back to a calm first-person narrative. It seemed relaxing to me after the others. Though the one I'm planning in the future, so it takes on yet another style. I feel that I'm still experimenting, and I hope that continues.
Tell me about your childhood and what... did you have a literary household as you grew up?
Not really, no. I mean, people read, but it wasn't a... I was not sitting in a library reading the classics. As a matter of fact, I sort of came in the back door. It was because I enjoyed writing that I began reading. And I'm more so in college than I had ever done growing up. Though I had always written as a kid, I enjoyed making up stories and writing stories and had always done it.
But your parents didn't guide you in any way in terms of being a writer. What did they do?
My dad is about to retire. He works at the post office in Lumberton. And my mother is retired. She was a medical secretary.
Mm-hmm. And what did you go on to college?
University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill.
Are you teaching there now?
I am.
Oh, tell me about that.
I love it.
Are you living in Chapel Hill?
Just over the line in Durham.
Mm-hmm.
And I teach two classes of creative writing. And so I work the 2 days a week, and then the rest of the time I'm at home. So it's an ideal schedule. And, of course, I have summer off and a nice long break at Christmas when I get a lot of writing done. But
so you have two classes a week.
Mm-hmm.
It's a grueling schedule.
Well, but not compared to working Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, which is what I was doing when I wrote the first two books and half of the third. So I still feel in many ways that I'm on vacation. It seems like a luxury schedule to me.
Yeah. What is it, a workshop situation?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have to take home manuscripts or to read? Or?
Yeah, it's a lot of reading at home.
Yeah. What kind of work are young aspiring writers, what kind of work are they doing?
It varies. A lot of them are experimenting stylistically, but a lot of the same types of stories that I think I saw when I was coming through the same program, they are finding their voices. I know I teach the honors seminar, and so these are students who have taken maybe three other creative writing classes, and they really take their work seriously, and they're giving me some very good stories. I taught at Tufts for 2 years, and I had taught at UNC, and then we were in Boston for 2 years, and I taught at Tufts, and now I'm back. So it was interesting for me to have Tufts sandwiched in between, because I realized that the students were writing, they were exploring the same turf of their generation. The difference, the differences were in their settings. So instead of small southern towns, they were taking place in New England.
Small New England. Town.
That's right. And, you know, the seasons were different. The dialect was different. What was blooming when was different. But overall, they were exploring their characters from the inside out, which is what I think it's all about.
I have this theory. I don't know how accurate it is, but it seemed to me that someone growing up in a small town is better off in terms of being a writer than someone who grows up in a large and personal city, because in a small town, this is only a theory, maybe you could comment on it, but in a small town you seem to be closer to neighbors, relatives, friends. You tend to know what other people are doing. They know what you're doing. If there's a scandal in town, everybody knows about it.
Exactly.
If somebody misbehaves, the neighbor is going to complain. I live in an apartment building in Manhattan. I know the next door neighbor, but the people across the hall, I wouldn't recognize them in the elevator. I have no idea. So it would seem to me it's more of a burden for a writer to focus on people in a larger city, because you're just not exposed that much. But in a small town where you've grown up, and you cited some other examples of some of your writing students, you have such proximity to other people that you might be able to exploit that in terms of being a writer.
Yeah, well, and I feel that by growing up in a small town, when I did, in many ways I had the best of both worlds. I grew up in that sheltered environment of a small town with an extended family. Both sets of grandparents were in that town. Two of those grandparents had also grown up in that county, and so I had a strong sense of the history of the place, as well as the people who lived there. But also, because of the media, I had access to what was going on in the rest of the world, which is one thing that's explored somewhat in Ferris Beach, Katie's obsession with the radio and seeing how far she can get from home, listening late at night. And I can remember, I have some cousins who were living in Phoenix, and I can remember them coming for a visit and being amazed that they had the same television shows and were listening to the same music. And there was a sense of connection there that I think prior generations of Southerners did not necessarily have. I-95 also came through my town when I was growing up and doubled the size. And there, too, was another sense of connection to what was going on elsewhere.
Now, I should have commented that you do have a nice sense of the time in the book because of your references to the movies and the television shows and the books. I think you have references. I can't remember them all now, but
yeah.
you felt that this was a time.
Well, I think that it's impossible to write about an adolescent without getting into what's going on socially on that pop culture level. I know there's a lot of talk about it these days, but I think when you're dealing with an adolescent, that's the world. The music and the television, and that's how you identify with each other.
Because back in my day, we didn't have television. Actually, the neighbors had television sets, but my father was the last on the block, so he got a television. He was waiting for color. This was in the 1950s. He was waiting for color, and he swore he wouldn't get a television set until it came out in color. He finally, my senior year in college, I was away in college, he finally broke down and bought a television set. Black and white, of course, because color was years. When did color come out? In the 70s, I guess, right?
Yeah.
Mid, late 70s, something like that. For most of us.
Yeah, for us,
yeah. For most of us. So I was very deprived of the teacher in class would say, class, how many of you watched such and such a show last night? And every hand in class went up, including mine. And I swore I was not going to be the only kid in class that hadn't seen that show and admit it. I was talking to Reynolds Price, because you're teaching a more advanced level of creative writing, but Reynolds Price was telling me, or complaining about some of his students, and they were giving him science fiction and things like that, which he didn't care for very much. But when I was an adolescent, that was my bridge to adult literature. My mother used to complain bitterly that it's all I read. Don, all you do is read science fiction. And she was probably right when I was 13, 14. But you expand your horizons, of course, and I thought that that was very helpful. I still have my old science fiction collection.
Sure.
All of my Galaxy magazines, Astounding. And I thought that was, if I had a kid who read science fiction, I would not complain.
But I think what's important is that you read.
Yeah.
I got stuck on the animal books. Black Beauty, Old Yeller, Where the Red Fern Grows. And for years, you know, if the main character wasn't a cat or a dog or a horse, I didn't read it. And but at least I was reading. And
but you wouldn't complain if one of your students gave you a science fiction story, would you?
No, I don't know the genre well enough. And I've told them that before because there's a whole language that goes along with it and words that apparently have become accepted terminology, and unless you read science fiction you don't understand what this is or this. And so I always ask that they provide me with a glossary so that I understand. But when I do get a science fiction story, I try to examine it in terms of whether or not it works, because I think that's what the workshop is all about. And it's hard not to voice likes and dislikes and personal taste, but I try to hold that for last when I'm dealing with my students. What I want them to do is to accomplish the idea that they have. And I try to encourage them to establish a base of reality, which in science fiction, I maintain that it's a step harder, because not only do you follow all the rules of basic fiction, but you have to go a step further in creating this world and make the reader believe everything that's happening. And so when we do get a science fiction story, we approach it. I do say that you can't suddenly have a Deedle Bopper appear that can do this and this and this without having prepared the way.
Now, I see what you mean. It's to write a science fiction story, it's harder to draw on your own experience in your own world.
Yeah.
You have to start fresh.
Right.
I've been reading some science fiction. I have a hard time with it now, and some fantasy, and it's also a challenge to the reader. You won't want to get into it. I mean, I can sympathize with your world. I mean, it's also part of my world. To go out to another galaxy it's sometimes a little hard, even though you would admire the writing.
Right.
And the skill of the writer, but it's a personal taste. Did Algonquin publish your earlier books?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Tell me, what advice do you give to the students in your workshops about how to get published?
My advice is always to start with a goal that is within reach and to slowly allow it to grow. Maybe to submit stories to the campus literary magazine and build in that way. Though I work with people, I have a colleague who recommends that you start at the New Yorker and
work down.
And work down. But I don't think I could have stood that. I think that when I was an undergraduate, I was at a stage where if someone had looked at me and said, "Give it up, you'll never be a writer," I probably would have said, "Okay," and gone looking elsewhere, because I was not that sure of myself. And it was by achieving small goals one at a time that gave me the self-confidence to grow And so in a lot of ways it depends on the individual, but I just tell them that the best advice I can give is that if you want to write, then do it. Rather than talking about what you eventually want to write, go in the room and start doing it. And show it to people and get feedback.
What about this feeling of rejection that almost every writer I've talked to has had? Alan Gerganis, a fellow Southerner, was telling me when he came on the broadcast last year, wrote this wonderful book called The Oldest Living Confederate Widow Tells All.
Right.
And he was telling me that in 1974, through the help of John Cheever, he published a story in The New Yorker. And he went out and celebrated at a big bash, and he said, "This is the beginning of my literary career." That was the last story he ever sold to The New Yorker, and the last story he sold for years. And he was telling me just as recently as last year that when he opens his mail, he gets one, two, three, or four rejection slips in the mail every week and bilts. And that's the way it's been his entire writing career.
Yeah.
So are your students aware of this? Even for someone who had the success with this novel, is still finding this rejection, which seems to be overwhelming in this field.
Yes, and I remind them that that is a part of the game. I've always been very glad that I received that kind of severe warning from my professors, because I did. I was encouraged to continue writing, but I was warned that I may never publish or it may take forever. And I guess what they were saying in essence was, do it because it's what you want to do, not to make any kind of name or reach any certain level. No, because it is very competitive, Anna.
But you do have this feeling, this creative impulse and the artistic drive that should be paramount.
Yeah, and that's why I say before I let go, I make sure that I have something else well underway.
Well, Jill McCorkle, this is certainly a beautiful book and very nicely done. I enjoyed reading it very much and certainly enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you.
Thank you
nice to
much.
Be here.